Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
As Professor Hall indicated, we want to start talking about Snow Crash today by talking about the virus in it. We began talking a little bit about the virus in the first time we discussed this book, but as you clearly saw, the definition of a virus expanded dramatically over the course of the book. So, you know, just what is the virus, the Snow Crash virus? Yes, Seth.
A religious virus.
What does that mean?
It goes into the core of your brain and...
You better speak up for
that. It goes into the core of your brain and restructures it to the point where you can't even control it because it's so basic that you have no idea that what it's doing. It's just maybe deep.
And it propagates just like real life.
In the metaverse, it's a word virus, but it's written in binary. So only the hackers who will get infected are the ones who can read the code.
Because they're the only ones that can read binary code. I have read before that even for very hardcore computer programmers, reading binary is quite hard.
Not the guy in Matrix.
The guy in Matrix, which is, of course, one of the more realistic depictions of computer technology of our time.
Point of the virus is that it goes subconsciously into your head, so like they can't necessarily read the code, but they're so used to dealing with code.
That could be an explanation.
Well, subconsciously, they might be able to read it. They might be able to
get the gist of it.
It means something.
Yeah. That's good. Yes.
And then isn't it in the real world? Isn't it spread by like snorting infected blood?
The serum? They take the serum from infected people and then they.
How does that work? How does blood infect you with a computer virus?
It's a biological virus as well.
How can you get the same virus from computer and biological agents?
Because you're transferring the material.
And the symptoms are psychological.
That's Seth's point about it being a religious virus as well. Let's bracket religious virus for a minute because that has a whole bunch of interesting issues to talk about. But you haven't explained how a biological agent and a computer virus could, on some conceivable level, be the same agent, Chris.
Well, I guess when it infects the person via the computer and it messes up their brain, like the blood goes to the brain, gets swished around the virus,
That's not right.
they both restructure the brain. They just work in different ways.
How do they work?
It said something about messing with like the very core, like the brain stem.
That is the result. Now this was right there in the book. You all guys need to learn to be close readers. I want to know the mechanism by which a computer virus infects you and a biological agent infects you. I want to know how Stevenson fancifully but plausibly says those two things function in the same fashion. Okay, what kind of biological agent is it?
So it's kind of like herpes simplex.
Yes, exactly. Now you're on the right track. How does herpes simplex...
It changes your DNA.
Right.
Recombinant DNA.
I've had it up for 10 minutes.
I was going to say that. I was like, is he like trying to...
Right? Is he like trying to give you a hint? This is a multimedia classroom. You're getting intellectual stimulation from all sides.
That's what a biological virus does, but how does an infological virus do that?
Okay, so get back to herpes simplex. We have some biomed majors in here. How does herpes simplex infect you? Yes, Seth.
I don't know the exact name, but it incorporates itself into the DNA. And like something like stress or something can bring it out, and that's where it'll come out usually towards your lips and stuff and break out, and then but then it'll come back in and stay dormant for a little while.
Right.
Lysogenic.
Good start. Yes.
Lysogenic. I was just going to say a phage comes by and injects the DNA in, which was kind of before what he said, and then it reproduces into other cells. Yeah,
and don't you remember the passages in here where he talked about certain kinds of agents that can penetrate cellular walls? That would be this virus can. And so once it does, and it alters the DNA, what is it altering?
The DNA.
Yeah. What's it altering?
The basic structure of each cell. I mean, the identity of the cell, basically.
It's altering sequences of GATC.
Nucleotide sequences.
It is.
I don't know if this is what you're going for, but maybe proteins made.
Well, definitely, if it alters that, it changes the proteins that are expressed by it and how, or perhaps how they fold. So what you have is a change in the code, the genetic code. And computer viruses are made of binary codes. So that is Stevenson's gambit. You know, this is a science fiction. But he makes it plausible by saying that they both operate on the level of code. You know, one's a code that is run on silicon machines, and the other's a code that's run on carbon-based life forms. And that's how he thinks these can be interchangeable. It's fanciful, but it's plausible. Yes.
My bio teacher last year didn't really believe that humans had free choice. He said that we were just basically like a computer, except a lot more complicated. Mm-hmm. Because everything that happens, like, you may think you're making a decision, but it's really just, you know, a series of reactions going up.
Right. So there's a virus of that going around. It's called people who pay attention, believe in evolutionary psychology. And some of them might be infected right here at Vanderbilt University, but we have the antivirus in the English department. So, how then, having set up this analogy between the computer code, biological code, how does he then extend the analogy to a religion? How is religion a virus in this book?
It's like an idea that's being spread quickly from person to person to person. They call it like a viral idea, I believe, is the term they use. So it just spreads so quickly and it just takes over and it changes the way people think about things.
It changes you at your core and your core beliefs, just like it changes the DNA, which is the core of your stuff.
That's pretty good. Is it a code?
Glossolalia.
Yeah.
Intellectual wisdom. So maybe the code makes you more likely to buy into the religious things.
It's speaking tongues.
Were people upset by that? I mean, one could imagine this, perceiving this book as a really atheistical book. You know, it's accusing various world religions of being nothing but viral plagues
I mean, if it's not like viral, then the religion's going to die out because it's not catching on anywhere and no one's believing in it. So you want a viral religion, so you spread it and other people believe in it and you have more followers.
You need convincing evidence to suggest that.
What a letter.
You need convincing evidence to suggest that what you're believing and sending out to the world, you want people to believe that, so in the sense, it has to be viral for it to succeed, like Chris said.
Viral isn't always a bad thing.
Okay.
You know, I mean, just where we usually we experience it in a bad context, but in terms of religion, it can also be profitable.
Because in terms of religion, a virus in our bodies gives us bad results, whereas whenever we're restructuring religion, is often it has good results, whereas someone is more.
So, what are there other things that seem to function as viruses in this novel besides religion, computer viruses, and biological viruses?
Well,
yeah.
advertisement on Broadway, or is it Broadway? Yeah. Like they said, it started up just the street.
The street.
It started out nothing, but now you couldn't walk without seeing everything. Just
excellent. More along that line. Anything else?
Oh, the chains. The chains.
The franchises are viral. Oh, yeah. So that you see how well this is put together. That you know, you start this novel with this hilarious, but also bitingly satiric vision of an America fragmented into, you know, wholly owned subsidiary countries and franchises, and you think, well, this is just great fun, but it's just this setting for the novel. But in fact, by the middle or toward the end, it's turned back into the theme of the novel, that the United States has already become infected itself with these intense viruses of franchising and advertising. So what'd you all make of the linguistic part? Well, first of all, how did you like this whole stuff about the, you know, Asherah and Enkidu, what's the name? Enki. Namshubs.
Very interesting.
I was actually curious if any of that's true.
Yeah, that's.
I didn't bother to check.
I've never heard it before, but it sounds.
The author usually seemed pretty convincing. The author usually researches this stuff, because I've read some of his other stuff. He usually goes crazy into his research. So I'm assuming that most of it is.
I think it was Sumerian mythology, and I think it's true.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know.
You don't just make up Sumerian mythology?
The Mesopotamian mythology also. The different deities. You could really tell that they were true if you searched it.
Of course, now, we're using a little bit of a viral program here up on our big screen. We've got a wiki, which is, of course, kind of a viral method of disseminating knowledge.
Wisdom of crowds.
It's the wisdom of crowds. So, you know, you've got a circularity here. I noticed right up ahead above, Professor Hall, would you scroll up slightly?
I just saw
a Tower of Babel right there. This gradually raised the temples above the level of the surrounding buildings so that eventually a temple platform, ziggurat, was constructed, raising the temple toward the heavens, possibly the origin of the biblical story of the of the Tower of Babel. But it's entirely possible, because we're looking at Wikipedia at this moment, that whoever wrote that was influenced by reading Snow Crash rather than a great circularity, a kind of viral infection of a Wikipedia entry. So what you'd have to do to find out if the Tower of Babel was a regular association with this topic is go to sources published prior to Snow Crash, because this has been one of the more influential popular texts of our time, and look and see if it played that prominent a role. Yes, sir, Chris.
Well, if you scroll down, it usually gives like the actual sources that it was derived from.
Okay.
They might have
plug yourself into.
Yeah, well, go for it. Yes, Tim.
The only reason I would say that may not have been from Snow Crash is because in Snow Crash, didn't they say that it wasn't actually a tower to the heavens, but that it had the heavens on the top of it? So I would think they'd mention that if it was coming from Snow Crash.
Mike said, he must have done a lot of research. Well, a good number of the books and the scholarly books mentioned as you read along are actual books. I've read some of them, not all of them. I know they exist. You could have gone to Acorn and, you know, checked each and every one of them if you wanted to. Yes, there's research, and he not only draws on it, but he puts a lot of his sources into the text. He does it. Sometimes a novelist will put a note on sources at the end. He kind of weaves them in to the text. But yes, he did a lot of research on Sumerian mythology. You all liked it? What have you got here for us?
Well, I just went to one of the easier ones from library.vanderbilt.edu, Britannica Online, where their articles run deep, does cite
Tower of Babel.
the Tower of Babel, and it also said the myth may have been inspired by the Babylonian Tower Temple north of Marduk Temple. And this is Britannica, obviously, has deep and long standing roots.
Beginning to get more authoritative. I'm still suspicious of Neal Stephenson's long reach into the scholarly community. No, of course, I think that's probably right, that it was inspired by the temple north of Marduk. Good. So everybody liked all those long passages.
It kind of got a little...
It was interesting.
I mean, it was interesting, yes. But then again, it kind of went on.
How many people? Interesting, yes. How many?
Sometimes.
I found myself drifting in and out of it every so often.
But you're permitted to, though.
Yeah. Because
you are permitted to in this genre of literature. In fact, you could sort of see one that were not that skillfully done. You know, he'd log in and say, let's resume our discussion. You know, you could, at that point, you could go like that and go straight ahead and not lose too much. On the other hand, so we had maybe four or five people that thought they were interesting. How many positively didn't like them? Anybody? Found them boring? What category am I missing, then, of those that are not voting? How many didn't read the novel? I forgot that. How many didn't read the novel category? Any hands there? Okay, so what?
Maybe
so what are we
I just
talking
thought
here?
They were like kind of unnecessary for like the plot,
mm-hmm.
and like most of the things that he does in the novel, like he creates society in a way that like it applies to like his metaversal world, and like he does a lot of things like for a reason. But I thought that like the stories that he used here like didn't really like have like a you know a real purpose, Chris.
Well,
thank you, Mel.
Well, now, well, at the end, he kind of relates everything back, and he like keeps he refers to Juanita as like Inanna or whatever, and all the stuff like the antenna on her head, and he relates everything to all the mythology that's being told throughout the whole book. But like the overall story was a little difficult to like I don't know, about like a third of the book was probably just narration of religious history, and I was just not fully into it the whole time.
So you were on the negative side, but you weren't voting.
I said I was in the middle. I mean, I thought it was really interesting how everything was kind of like had a parallel in his actual world. But
who's Enki then?
Alright. I don't know. That's probably part I skipped of the narrative.
Hero.
There's an analog.
How is Hero Enki?
Because Enki is the one who like broke up the language into all the other languages with the Namshub, and that's what Hero.
And Hero saved all the people on the
counter-virus.
Yeah, Hero saved Juanita, like Enki saved Inanna. Yep.
And didn't he say that Enki was a hacker god?
Yes.
Yeah.
He didn't disguise it too much. So that we got Hero protagonist, hacker god. I mean,
Hero sounds like H-E-R-O. I thought his name was a little redundant. The hero protagonist.
Professor Hall is tuning in.
Make sure we get this captured.
But I thought it was cyclical, just like our.
Yeah, it was cyclical. In fact, this is a 21st century version of Sumerian mythology,
exactly.
And Christianity had it. So each generation will have to produce their own hero protagonist, hacker gods, and so that's why we're trying to turn you. Into.
I'll be a hacker.
Hacker gods.
I can deal with that.
So a visual, not
so
a necessarily
so much
visual pun of, between being a hacker hero and a sword wielding hero? Do you think he means that?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I mean, the back of the book even says he's like a warrior prince in the Metaverse. So, I mean, we're not subtle about it.
Not subtle about it. Yes, sir.
I thought it was kind of interesting that his two, like, things that he's very good at, one is, like, very technologically advanced, and the other is swords from, like, the 1300s or something like that.
And so, again, I was trying to point out that as though these two things seem so far apart, that there's a kind of thematic link woven into the text between that. And then, you know, I think it has had cultural ramifications in through movies like Kill Bill. I mean, I'm not saying that Stevenson gets... I mean, that Kill Bill gets the interest in samurai sword fighting from Stevenson. But the association between hacker and technology began to...
There's something else I want to offer in here, particularly as it relates to Inky and the counter virus. Having the languages broken up is very important here, because this is not only a statement about all the things we discuss in a literary sense, it's also about diversity. Having diverse systems means you have resilient systems.
Great. Keep talking. I want to hear more about
Well, and if you look at the computer analog, what's... Everybody likes to pick on Microsoft, for example, today's world. Why is Microsoft, do you think, so prone to a virus?
So big,
everybody
has it.
So big.
That's what everybody has the exact same thing.
It's homogeneity. It's standard. So people can write their viruses to a standard. Was the metaverse a standard development platform? What do you think? Max is nodding. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it started with just one street and allowed anybody to do whatever they want to it.
What if there were two metaverses independent? Could the cards have transmitted in the same way if they were not connected?
No.
Sure, they could figure out a way to do that.
They might have been set up.
Isn't that like the idea of having two internets? Like, I almost think of the metaverse as like a 3D internet.
I think it's a good conception.
Yeah,
But I think the metaverse is for, it's largely for commerce and for interaction between people, whereas the internet is a place for accessing information.
It's
a
librarian.
Well,
I think there's a didactic message in here, whether it's intentional or not. There is strength in diversity. When you go to Japan as a society, from which a lot of these cyberpunk novels get their general ideas and theme and ambiance, that is a very homogeneous society. You come to the United States, it's a very diverse society, and there is strength in diversity. When one of the things that, being a kind of cattleman from the state of Florida, we ran into a lot of pine trees, and there were two different types of pine, but one of the pine was called a loblolly pine. And what you wanted to do was put essentially firewalls in your pine tree groves so that if certain blights were to hit your trees, there would be a break in the population. That after all these pines could get blighted out and die, there would be a certain strain of pine that wasn't susceptible of the same genetics traits of these trees, and it would stop. So it would protect the rest of the population.
Evolution.
So think about this as this is not only about, and if you think about, we touched at the beginning of our discussions, the racial composition of hero, you know, all the different, and you know, the white bird claves, the stereotypes about these southern colonial mansions, and you know, whites only can enter, that South African sort of apartheid era. There's more to this socially. This is a didactic lesson experience.
So are you suggesting that that the novel is recommending that kind of fragmentation into discriminatory bird claves?
Not at all. I think that's diversity and racism taken to absurdity, like viral chains.
I think he's making fun of it.
I think he's making fun of it. Mm-hmm. I agree with Chris.
Kind of like the Mark Twain novels, which came under fire as being racist, but really all the characters in the novels that are being racist are really just like the most uneducated, illiterate, like the characters you hated in the novels. So.
Good analogy. And of course, there's specific scenes that show Stevenson's racial attitudes, and the one that the novel wants us to absorb. Can you think of a particular scene?
Yeah,
that's Herod.
The new South Africa guys in the bar, and they're like, "Should we kill you because you're black, or should we kill you because you're Japanese?" Right.
But some racial slur.
Yeah. Pick two racial slurs. Which of them shall we kill you for?
Either or.
And look at the protagonist. He was racially diverse.
And so that was
a
pretty satisfying scene, though. Go ahead and tell the scene for our listening audience.
He cuts the guy's head off.
runs for his life.
Yeah.
Well, but plus, there must have been about 20 of them surrounding him, and he slashes his way off. Out of there, yes.
I thought the funniest part though was he was like, So, do you plan on, like, attacking me? And he's like, yeah, whatever. It's like, well, I'm glad you made your intentions clear so I can do this. And then, whack.
So, yes, that's exactly right. And he does, Stevenson does use scene, that scene and others like it to establish his point of view, his satirical perspective on such a thing. But it does set us up with a kind of a funny dissonance here, a discontinuity here between a support for diversification and yet a critique of apartheid, of separatism. Does the novel successfully resolve that, show you a way through that opposition or not? It's a very abstract question. We may have to save an answer until we've, you know, continued our discussion. But try and keep that question in your mind. If it was clear enough. Was the question clear enough?
Yeah.
If it is talking about how diverse systems mean resilient systems, which is a clear endorsement, and we're going to turn to counterviruses and talk about counterviruses, and we're going to talk about the linguistic event of the Babel in a moment. All of that is on the side of diversification, of not too much uniformity, too much conformity. And yet, there's a society that is diversified to the max, no pun intended, diversified to ridiculous extremes so that every franchise is its own separate corporation. And so there possibly is a conflict, a kind of intellectual contradiction, if you will, in the book between these two impulses. And I want you to think about how you might try to resolve that contradiction, or if you just want to leave it that the author contradicts himself.
Well, I want to offer this in the evidence as to, and you can assess Professor Clayton's question in light of this. Chris, would you just do us a favor and read these sections out loud? I think this may be germane to this point.
At some point, Enki realized that Sumer was stuck in a rut. People were carrying the same old me all the time, not coming up with new ones, not thinking for themselves. I suspect that he was lonely, being one of the few, perhaps the only, conscious human being in the world. He realized that in order for the human race to advance, they had to be delivered from the grip of this viral civilization. So he created the Nam-Shum of Enki, a countervirus that spread along the same routes as the me and the metavirus. It went into the deep structure of the brain and reprogrammed them. Henceforth, no one could understand the Sumerian language or any other deep structure-based language. Cut off from our common deep structures, we began to develop new languages that had nothing in common with each other. The me no longer worked, and it was not possible to write new me. Further transmission of the metavirus was blocked.
I'm going to submit, and then I'd like to see if you discuss it, or Jay, you can move on to a different topic. Implicit in these two paragraphs is the answer to Professor Clayton's question.
What do you think? Can you tease it out of those paragraphs? Shall we talk about the antivirus or the countervirus? Some, to get us ready to analyze those passages. So what are some of the counterviruses in the novel? Matt, you're about to speak.
I was just going to try to...
Okay, well, go for it.
Like, the only way, if everyone's infected, and you have to take what everyone knows, and you have to erase that so that the virus is killed.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they fend for themselves to try to recoup, they create all these new things and the new languages or whatever, and that's the diversification that's needed so that it will never happen again. But then he's saying it's kind of cyclical because eventually everyone will come back together.
Sorry, Matt, I was trying to signal, but it wasn't silent.
Oh.
Keep going with the diversity part.
And, like, when they all broke apart, that gives them the defense of not all being the same, not having different characteristics, and that's what makes you good. That's why the diversity.
It's going back to, like, the Microsoft analogy. That's kind of, like, what Apple, the guys at Apple took into consideration. Like, everyone has
you know, most of the people have PCs, and like the way that Apple does it is they have their computer, and there are no viruses written for Mac OS. So like that's sort of another sort of antivirus, is to bring in a new sort of species of, you know, like a new medium. So that's more diverse than the more common. So.
Just from reading these two paragraphs, I kind of get the feeling that, I don't know if this answers your question, I don't know if I fully even understand your question yet, but by taking away the one thing they have in common, which is language, I feel like if anything, that'll create separation in the South African way we were talking about, because if you don't have language in common, you look for something else, and the easiest things are usually skin color, you know, gender, that kind of thing. So if any, I don't know if that helps with anything.
Yeah, and it reduces mutual comprehension if you don't have language in common. Yes, Wesley.
I'm sort of confused about how it sort of talks like this, like it's a great thing that it happened and it was diversified. But he also talks about the diversification in like the franchises as a dystopia. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously a dystopia. And without being able to work together, then that's what it makes them stronger that they're diverse. But without them being able to work together and be diverse at the same time, it can't be efficient.
That is the question. And Tim, did you hear his reformulation of the question? Because it was, I thought, another pretty vivid way to frame my question.
I can't see how it's not contradictory.
I was just going to say that with the computers, like, there's viruses that are written for, like, Windows, and then there's Mac, and then as more and more computers, like, could come out to where they're different, like, you're trying to diversify the number of computers, different operating systems that are out there so you don't get a virus. But there comes a point where the different computers get cut off from a common language, as he was saying in here, so that they don't work, it's hard to work like together with each other. If you have one computer and I have another, and he has a different one, he has a different, we're all trying to do the same thing, but with different like programs, it'll be very difficult.
Whenever you want to go, just give me the nod.
This is good.
Okay, Chris.
Well, that was a good point there, because if you diversify everything, yeah, it'll keep like viruses will be hard to write that'll affect all the systems, but. Games will be hard to write, or like good things would be hard to write for that. Like, we already had problems with people trying to like run Lord of the Rings online with Mac. Like,
yep.
It's the give and take if you diversify, I guess.
That sure is.
I think it depends on your culture, though. In our culture, we emphasize individuality, and like Japan, where it's the group consciousness. Well, here we try to diversify that. That's how we approve ourselves for it. I think as some cultures, you know, would try and have all these different kind of computer systems, when like maybe in Japan it's all standard. And I think it's really about your mentality too. Not just, you know.
Jeff and then Daniel.
Could the answer to your question be no? But he just set up a paradox and
Well, that's sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, is not it?
Well, that is a paradox. So no, it's not a contradiction. It's a paradox, is your answer?
Okay. Or is it mean? Are you keep going with your thought, or are you trying to say the story is just a story?
Well, I mean, just the paradox of the diversification combined with too much.
Resulting in racism and mutual antagonism. Interesting. I mean, that's a very interesting, and I guess that is what several people have been trying to say, that you get benefits and then but at a cost sometimes. Daniel, then Greg, then Matt.
I'm not exactly where I'm going with this, mm-hmm. but it seems like, you know, you have the virus that spreads through and it affects all these computers because they're all the same, and you try to diversify the type of computer that's out there so that the virus can't affect it, but like you get to the point where you can't communicate between computers, you don't have the same common language. But another problem in there is that the population, amount of users out there affects how fast and how much the virus will spread.
You were exactly right, that concentration of population, number of users really affects incidence. So you want to show that really quickly?
to Daniel's point, this isn't, and Michael and I were talking about this a bit before class, IBM's got over 40,000 patents. One of the areas of research that you're going to hear a lot about in coming years is called biomedical informatics. It's a combination of biological sciences and mini biological science meeting the computational power of computers. What this technology is, I saw this up in White Plains last year when we went up for some research for Vanderbilt, spatiotemporal epidemiological modeler. That's a fancy thing to say. That is, if a virus were to break in one of these spots, and I have a map of the United States here, how long would it take for a contagion to rage from here throughout these populations? Now, a lot of studies have been done by taking a $20 bill or a series of money and spreading them out through populations. You'd be surprised with today's mass transit how quickly biological contaminants can be moved through the continental United States. It's very quick. And this is a modeler that allows you to express different scenarios, and it's for first response planning around particularly the flu. Who's heard of the bird flu? This is the avian flu. This all goes back to a time that we've already experienced this in the United States. Jay, do you know much about the 1918 influenza epidemic?
I know more than the commonplace knowledge, which was that during World War I, this epidemic spread, and the fatality rate was amazing, both in percentage of the population that died when they got it, but also just in raw numbers. Many more people died of influenza in the United States than died in the war.
And it washed over the United States. The beginning spot, to Daniel's point, was in the Boston area up in the Northeast. The soldiers were coming back from Spain. They sometimes call it the Spanish influenza. Coming back from Europe, and it started up in Boston area at a U.S. Army base for returning troops. It spread wildly within a matter of months across, even in the 1918 with that level of mass transit. But what allowed it to spread? Population concentration, close contact. It goes right back to Enki. And I would put forward here that the statement, and it's implicit in these two paragraphs, diversity is good. It provides a value. Homogeneity, I think he's making a statement. At some point, Enki realized that Sumer was stuck in a rut. That rut was one homogeneous me. So they had to have a countervirus to that homogeneity, and they broke it. That's a lot of concepts broken, you know, put into one thing. We had this happen in the United States biologically. I think you see it all the time intellectually when a new idea hits. You've heard of the term viral marketing. What's viral marketing, Leslie? You heard of it?
I mean, I've heard of it. I probably couldn't define it.
Anybody want to take a stab at it?
Hey, Greg?
It's just like, it's been recently used by like video game developers and stuff to just infect people with their idea through some extreme means. Like, there was a website last year that was, it just had a countdown on it, and throughout the pages that you could go to, you saw that, like, it supposedly linked to the national security defense at U.S. like national headquarters, and people were getting up in arms like in various forums outside of this website saying like it's the end of the world, like nukes are going to fall on the U.S. when this countdown ends, and then like at the end it was just like buy Doritos tomorrow or something. So like it's basically just a way to market by infecting people through an extreme means like fear or...
And you just spread the virus of Doritos.
Yeah.
There they went. It worked.
Right to us and to our listening audience. Yes, Chris.
Chris and
Mike. I'm sorry, Matt had his hand up earlier. We're past? Okay, go ahead, Chris.
It's here, a little definition. It says, viral marketing and viral advertising refer to marketing techniques that use pre-existing social networks to produce increases in brand awareness through self-replicating viral process, analogous to the spread of pathological computer viruses.
Excellent.
I think Facebook is a good example of that. I see, you know, that kind of apps and stuff that advertise all the time on Facebook.
But a virus, if it's isolated, is of what kind of value? Isn't its job to propagate itself? Mm-hmm. If it's cut off and contained,
it'll die out,
or it'll lie dormant. In the case of the influenza, there's different variants on this. You'll hear a swine flu as well. It was actually, Ted, it was up in Alaska where they dug up graves to get a copy of the virus, where it just sitting dormant.
But the key, and I want to make sure Michael gets his chance in this, the key themes is network, whether that's a pathological network, a social network, or a physical network. It was required that people, places, things be connected. And this is why the population centers are so important for a virus to take hold. Michael, what was your...
Just like viral marketing. You got to just get people to talk about it. And a lot of times when you get really concentrated groups of people, they'll play off each other and get more excited about it. And they'll tell more people quicker than if you have a few people loosely connected around the country. And so it's getting people worked up and telling people really quickly.
I think that is you. We've now properly emphasized network, and that's a really key feature to viral contagion. But the other side we haven't talked enough about, which is that Stevenson's suggesting that information is the other element that's required. That virus is nothing but information. Biologically, it's DNA.
It's a big debate whether viruses are living organisms.
Exactly. Exactly. Virus is DNA. Computer code is information. And then that goes back to religion as information or advertising as information. So that you have these two things, how information moves through a network is the core structure of a virus, according to Stevenson's novel, I think. So what about the countervirus? What are some of the counterviruses in the book? Inky is one, clearly. Okay, how does a Nam-Shub work?
They can no longer understand the language. It just breaks down understanding.
It sounds to me almost like a virus itself, because it does a very similar thing. It does the same thing. It just reprograms, the thing, but it just blocks out the other viruses.
Whatever his anti-snow crash virus in the metaverse is called, snow scan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There was a.
And they just filtered it.
Yeah, that wasn't really an anti-virus though. I just looked for it.
Well, any other antiviruses in the novel? In fact, there were several others. They were in the passages that some of you were phasing out on. The best discussions of them. Let's go back just for a moment to the way in which these passages on Sumerian mythology and on linguistics were incorporated in the novel. Wesley murmured when we first raised that question. He murmured, "It's like the Da Vinci Code."
Yeah.
How is it like the Da Vinci Code? The Da Vinci Code is a much later novel, so let us say the Da Vinci Code is like Snow Crash.
Well, I was talking about the references to female goddesses and the references to how they connect to other religions and all of the beliefs are connected in the icons, I think. And I thought how he took influences from from history, and it seemed like he took a one step further, kind of like Da Vinci Code did a little bit more. But I like this a lot better because I don't think he did it as much as whatever.
Other ways in which it is. Have you read other books, other novels that incorporate learning or spurious learning or half-plausible learning into the text? No?
Cryptonomicon.
You haven't even read the Da Vinci Code, Cryptonomicon, of course. Any others?
Half-plausible learning.
Yes.
The movie The Island, Flashing Pictures.
Movies do it.
Matrix. Download.
Yes. And Matrix even has book titles in it.
Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange, yeah. I'm trying to remember.
Programming spring.
Yes, maybe. That's awesome. A Moby Dick would be a good example. Professor Hall, could you look up on your Wikipedia, Menippean satire. I was about to type it up on the board, and I realized we could get it more quickly. Menippean satire.
Spell that, baby.
You're on it. No, E. M-E.
Keep going, bro. Hum a few more
bars.
P-A-N.
You know, now you're making me... I thought there was going to be two N's in there. So now you've just broadcast over the entire United States.
It's not live. I got editing capability.
I was having troubles.
Google will check for you. I would do a Google.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love Google will self-serve this.
Everyone can spell manipulate.
I don't know why Wikipedia doesn't get right.
Whatever you're talking about, in those...
Oh, look at that.
There you go. Okay.
Well, of course, Professor, I'd be happy to put that on the board for you. That's where we'll start.
Thank you. Menippean satire is a term employed broadly to refer to prose satires that are rhapsodic in nature, combining many different targets of ridicule into a fragmented satiric narrative similar to a novel. I'm looking for the where epic tragedy and philosophy are combined. Gulliver's Travels is a great you were?
Well, I mean, that's what I was thinking.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Good for you. Gulliver's Travels, Sartor Resartus, Rabelais, Gargantuan, Pentagril, Alice in the Wonderland, Lewis Carroll. Those are examples.
I love that one.
Right. Those are examples of Menippean satire. It didn't mention what I would have pointed out as one of the central characteristics, which is the weaving in of learning or sometimes spurious learning in a fictional text. And Snow Crash, you're right on the borderland between that. You know, there's obviously clear references to learned authorities, but then there's speculative passages that are clearly going way beyond what we really know for sure about Sumerian languages or linguistics. So he's writing in a very particular genre with these passages, and you notice how it says, you know, that there's that the tendency to flip back and forth between these kinds of passages is a characteristic of this kind of fiction. It's an ancient genre that has become more popular, in fact, in recent decades. Now, going back to the antiviruses, which the discussions of the antiviruses were in the passages about religion and about linguistics.
When we were talking about the Sadducees.
Yes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. Exactly. What were some of the great antiviruses in history, according to this?
Wasn't Jesus?
Jesus.
And then the Pentecost was the glossolalia. I keep messing that up.
Right.
The development of Hebrew as a language.
Say more.
They were just talking. I remember they mentioned like how it was such like a flexible or such a strong language or something, and it. It allowed them to like filter out the viruses that were affecting other people, something like that.
Well, I mean, there's one here. The ministry of Jesus Christ was an effort to break Judaism out of this condition. Was that an antivirus?
Legalism was the virus that they were trying to break them out of.
And they said even major phenomena like Bart Simpson T-shirts can have a way to be stamped out.
Pentecost from Acts. I got it down here. Acts 2, we'll just say. When Pentecost Day came around and they had all met in one room, when suddenly they heard what sounded like a powerful wind from heaven, the noise of which filled the entire house in which they were sitting, and something appeared to them that seemed like tongues of fire. These separated and came to rest on the head of each of them. They were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak foreign languages as the Spirit gave them the gift of speech. Now there were devout men living in Jerusalem from every nation under heaven. And at this sound, they all assembled, each one bewildered to hear these men speaking his own language. That's the great Pentecost scene, at which Stevenson, in a rather blasphemous way, if you think about it, says that that is like the snow crash virus in this imaginary world. How do you react to that? You're fine with it.
Sounds kind of brilliant.
Sounds kind of brilliant.
Yeah, I thought it was clever, but I didn't think it was plausible. I don't know how speaking, was it described as speaking in tongues in the Bible? It wasn't glossolalia.
No, glossolalia is speaking in tongues.
Yeah, but that wasn't what the Pentecost was.
So what he's saying is that glossolalia, that, for example, people in evangelical movements here in the South and out in Kansas and elsewhere around the country who, immediately start speaking in tongues or engaging in glossolalia, he says that what they're really doing is tapping into that brainstem, language of the brainstem, the primitive brainstem that Sumerian tapped into.
But I don't think that that's what the Pentecost was, because the Bible references speaking in tongues or glossolalia, and it doesn't say that in the Pentecost, does it? It just says they all understood each other. And whenever you're in glossolalia, isn't it supposed to be like a semi-transcendent, so where you don't remember or you don't understand what you're saying? And they understood what they were saying in the Pentecost.
Go ahead.
Well, the Bible is, it's been translated thousands of times, many, many times, been assembled hundreds of years after they were written and all that. So, it's plausible from the way he goes about it that was lost.
The Bible also has over 10,000 manuscripts with which to cross-reference, and I believe the Bible is written as it was in its original because of so many. I mean, if you look at Plato, it has like 400, and that's the max of any other. I think the Bible is written as it was whenever it was originally written.
So you've got a passage right there, Professor Hall?
Well, I wanted to go to Sikatone and Michael there. He brought this up about Hebrew as a language. Michael, did you want to elaborate on that a bit from what your point was?
Read it first. It says, after a few thousand years, one new language developed, Hebrew, that possessed exceptional flexibility and power. The Deuteronomists, a group of radical monotheists in the 6th and 7th centuries BC, were the first to take advantage of it. They lived in a time of extreme nationalism and xenophobia, which made it easier for them to reject foreign ideas like Asherah worship.
Isn't that an antivirus shield after a fashion?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I'll offer you this, the point where before we digress into a religious war in the class. We are all susceptible to the pull of viral ideas. This is Uncle Enzo conversation, Mr. League conversation, right? Like mass hysteria or a tune that gets into your head that you keep humming all day until you spread it to someone else. I'll do that intentionally sometimes and start singing a song to someone just to irritate them.
Yeah, right.
This is the song I never...
Okay,
there
and
you
now...
Go, there we go!
So I think it's easy enough to reconcile what Wesley was saying with what Michael was saying, too. And we can do that right before we go on, because Wesley is pointing out correctly that according to the passage that I just read, they are not saying that they're speaking in tongues.
Right.
They are saying that they can be heard by people, everyone in his own language. On the other hand...
Because of the deep structure.
On the other hand, every sect that I'm aware... Christian sect that I'm aware of that practices speaking in tongues thinks and claims they are reenacting this passage from the Pentecost.
Absolutely.
So you've got these both. You've got both of these things being true, and there's no contradiction between your two.
But again, the deep structure idea is still a structural mm-hmm. idea about standardization, which would allow that commonality mm-hmm. to take hold.
Okay, we got to move forward to finish this discussion. After he takes his call.
Official time.
Take care, Tim.
Chris claims 10 minutes official time left.
That was just a lot.
antivirus. Deuteronomy then was an antivirus. Christ was an antivirus. Enki, of course, was a hacker
God.
Antivirus. Who?
Hacker God.
Hacker God, exactly. The fall of Babel. More like that. There are more like that. Let's get your memory of the text operative here. Any more? Probably the most radical of all his claims. Actually, several of these are pretty darn radical. Jesus Christ is an antivirus. Hijacked 50 days later by the Pentecost. That's pretty radical. But that he claims that computer binary code is itself the antivirus.
Yeah, we're talking about the dualism.
Right. Explain it. It's an interesting concept. Can you? I mean, you've got it. You're on the right track. Dualism. He says another way to put it is that dualistic philosophies is an antivirus. That thinking dualistically is an antivirus. Thinking monistically is a virus. Does that make sense to you? Can you articulate that sense, anyone?
Well, whenever you're thinking dualistically, like within binary, there's an infinite number of possibilities. Within those two possibilities, you can have an infinite number of programs. But whenever you just had zeros, one zero is infected, and they're all infinite.
You know. And so there's those images on the stele of the zero and the one being handed. What Stevenson's driving at is that the basic cognitive procedure of Western thought is to divide in order to analyze, to separate things into categories, and that binary code, the very language of computers, is the kind of the example of how language and even thought itself depends on dividing in order to communicate. So going back to that initial contradiction or paradox about racist Berg claims, the virtue of diversification versus the virtue or the danger of diversification. Yes, sir.
Maybe saying we need both.
We do need both.
We need both to kind of balance each other out so that when one dominates, then it becomes susceptible or it's not good anymore. So you gotta hit.
And I'm liking more and more, the more I reflect on your notion of this paradox, the better I like it. That the very, and I guess this is maybe what you're driving at, that the cure is the same as the disease, Greg?
Well, I was about to say, because like I find it interesting that he calls Christ an antivirus when it's a monotheistic religion that he
instantiates.
And like that's totally, you know.
So we've got these cycles again and again. Deuteronomy established in monotheistic religion, or rather, it establishes the code of laws that enforced the monotheism, the pre-existing monotheism, but made it, you know, really established. And then it got corrupted, so you needed a new instantiation of monotheism to fix it.
Well, I think monotheism was the example of unified diversity, where they're all unified to the one God, but there's still diversity.
Because there's still a code. There's still a law and a code that depends on all those distinctions. If you think of the Deuteronomic laws, it's one of the most elaborate set of distinctions. You know, you still see those distinctions at work if you know any of your friends that follow strict dietary laws.
If you keep kosher, you know this.
Right. Yeah, strict dietary laws sees all these little distinctions that carve up the world into a code of behavior. And so any more comments about it? Then I want to What's our official time here, timekeeper?
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
10 seconds.
I want to ask one thing. We've talked about Stevenson's critique of racism. It's pretty much exonerated him from any potential charges of depicting endorsing racism. But what's your view of his relation to his gender relations?
You mean like if he's sexist or not? Or?
Well, that would be a sort of blunt way to frame the question, yes.
Well, no, he's not, because if anything, he goes kind of the opposite route, because he makes Juanita, like, so smart, and she, like, is one step ahead of him, like, the whole time. She keeps telling him stuff, and he's like, and she's like, well, just go look it up. I don't have time to deal with this. You idiot.
It's who YT covers right
here. Mikkel, then Ted.
Yeah, I mean, the two women characters that are really, like, in the story are very, very strong characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're able to take care of themselves. You know, they don't, you know, they're singular people rather than needing a man, you know, to help them. Fun stuff. They're more ahead than the men in many aspects.
There's like a really direct reference to like what Chris was saying about Juanita on page 63, when Hero talks about her and how like when she comes into the metaverse, it's really early in the novel, but we see this like when she comes into the metaverse in a black and white avatar, and he says this is really surprising because usually she was the one that figured out how to make these show the closest to real emotion. And he basically praises her for the next page and a half.
Okay.
And
63 to 64,
yeah.
We'll put that into our after class. We'll put that into our class notes so you can reference that passage.
What made this place a success was not the collision avoidance algorithms or the bouncer demons or any of the other stuff. It was Juanita's faces.
Okay. Any other things about his gender attitudes?
I think it's important, like, even though we've kind of established the fact that he's not sexist or racist, he still has his biases, and they show pretty distinctly.
Let's hear about him.
Like, well, he obviously has this romantic view of, like, Japanese culture and, like, sword fighting and stuff like that. And he also takes that, like, male perspective often of Juanita. Like, she is an object to be desired, like we were talking about with the, you know,
okay,
the film.
Okay.
I mean, you know, he's clearly not being, like, drastic about it. He's not, like, you know, racist. He's not pro-Japanese or Nipponese and, you know, anti-any other culture. But, like, he always has these biases showing through.
Yeah, but he has an identity.
Yeah, Chris had his hand up.
Chris.
Well, Hero gets saved multiple times by Juanita and Whitey, like, crashes his car, Whitey comes over and, like, grabs a pizza, I'll deliver it for you, whatever, you just do whatever, go get safe or whatever. Juanita's like, here, this is a virus, don't look at that card, you're gonna get killed, blah, 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 saves him again. So, Hero gets saved throughout the book.
I think Whitey's kind of different, there's a difference. Whitey's kind of fragile, she's 15 years old, and like, it requires Raven to keep her safe on the raft. And then, I mean, sometimes she's strong. She's very individualistic.
What about YT? Here she is. She's 15 years old. What about that sex scene between YT and Raven? Do you remember
that?
It's a little raunchy. You know, she describes him as a 300-pound, smelly, homicidal maniac. Every one of those adjectives is her view of him. And we're out of time.